If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Get it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the cock. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Line engine, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema is a four-weekly podcast which looks at and recommends movies that are more than 20 years old. The good, the obscure, the interesting, and the weird. Feedback is important. You can email it to cultguru with a K at gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U at gmail.com. Visit the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook or leave a recorded voicemail or comment at paleocinema.blogspot.com or drop a voicemail at our new number 206-309-4864. This podcast may contain adult concepts and language, but please don't be disappointed if it doesn't.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 114. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at two 1960s movies directed by the same guy, Joseph Losey, an American expatriate director who predominantly, after he was scared out of America by the House on American Activities Committee, worked in Europe and predominantly in the UK. Really interesting director with a very interesting string of films to his oeuvre. And the two movies I'm going to be talking about are one from 1960 starring Stanley Baker, one of the favourites here at Paleo Cinema, a movie called The Criminal, which has got a terrific ensemble cast, and something really, really different, probably the most different movie that Losey ever made, which is the 1966 spy spoof Modesty Blaze, starring Monica Vitti and Terra Stamp. So that's what we're going to be doing. So how is everybody? Sal and I have taken a week off in Darwin. We went back up to Darwin after a two-year break and spent a week up there. It was very hot, around 35 degrees every day and intermittently humid. We're coming to the end of the wet season in the Northern Territory, so you'll get days and days of dry heat, and then the humidity will clamp down like the lid on a saucepan, and that will change. Had a really great time. I did the radio three times while I was up there. First time I was just saying hi to Ivor. He did a vinyl night at a club called the Railway Club in Perap, in a suburb of Darwin. And we were there while he was spinning vinyl and caught up with a lot of people. We caught up with Ivor's wife, Casey, as well as Ivor. Met a couple of really nice people. Annie Gaston, who used to do the afternoon shift at ABC Darwin. We caught up with her. Did meet a couple of really nice guys called Brad and Phil, who run a farm outside Darwin where they grow heliconia plants. They're really kind of beautiful tropical flowering plants, and they sell them as a way of keeping the farm going. And on the Saturday we were up there, Sal stayed back at the room. She didn't want to go out. But I went for a barbecue up at Brad and Phil's farm. Like I said, it's about 60k out of Darwin. It's in the flat, scrubby country, and went through these rows of enormous flowering plants. Had a really great time. Their farm is fantastic. They've built a dam on the farm, so they've got a big kind of artificial lake there, and they're going to be building a house. And they live up there on weekends in what's basically an open-ended shed, an enormous kind of barn type thing. We had barramundi, which is one of the nice fish up there. Had a barbecue of barramundi and salads and had a few beers and sat outside around a campfire. And the beautiful thing that I saw while we were there is you can see satellites going overhead. That's how clear the sky is. And their little fox terrier dog barks at satellites, which blew me away. The fact that A, the dog can see the satellites going over, and B, it thinks they're attacking the house or something, and it barks at them every time they do go over. Now, the other really groovy thing was they lit a campfire, and the radio was on, blasting out kind of the kind of music that music stations on the radio play on a Saturday night, kind of 80s revival stuff. They had created a laser light show for their country farm with little flashing lights pulsing to the time of the music, and they're flashing through the smoke of the fire and all across the trees and across the heliconia plants. And it was just the most magical night of just hanging out, talking with people, having a really great time, and just chilling out in the tropics. Yeah, there were a few mosquitoes around, but we sprayed mosquito spray around. There wasn't really a problem. And the stars were incredibly clear. It was just a beautiful night. Beautiful, classic Northern Territory country hospitality. And I can only thank everybody concerned for the wonderful night I had, and for the time that Sal and I had too. We had dinner with Ivor Casey at their house, and that again was, everyone dines al fresco up there. It's so warm, they basically have a dining table under a big long veranda in their house, and everybody kind of lives outdoors almost. And that gave us a real feel for how people live in the Northern Territory, which was kind of groovy and a really seductive sort of lifestyle to have. Now, I said I did the radio three times. I did a little hi, how you going at the Railway Club, which is kind of basically an old juke joint on the edge of Darwin. I then did an hour, or about 40 minutes, with Ivor. We were talking about movie music, and I put in a few tracks which we discussed and played. Things like the theme from Danger Diabolic, we did that, and the theme from The Tenth Victim, Spiral Waltz, and some Marlene Dietrich. We did Push a Man from Curtis Mayfield's Superfly soundtrack, and a whole bunch of groovy tracks like that, just with Ivor and I having a chat in the studio and grooving on that. And then I did a little bit of a session the next day with Richard Margeson, who does the afternoon show, when we were talking about the Deck Chair Cinema, which was opening up again the day after we left Darwin. Now, the Deck Chair Cinema is fantastic. Open air cinema down by the waterfront. It's a really groovy place. And we had a chat with Stephen Noble, who runs the Deck Chair Cinema. So I got to meet him and talking about that. And I found out something really interesting about the Deck Chair Cinema. They got a big blackboard with chalk up on the back of the concession stand, where you can write suggestions for movies they could show at the Deck Chair Cinema, which I found really a groovy thing to do. So we talked about movies a little bit there, and basically Sal and I had a really nice week away from home, and so good was the week away from home that when we got back we were totally exhausted, and for the last 5 days basically we haven't done too much at all. We're just chilling out at home, re-establishing our relationships with the cats, and in general, not doing too much at all. So I did enjoy the time away. We do love Darwin. We will never be able to afford to live there unless somebody dies and leaves us a lot of money. But we do want to make it a regular holiday place for us. We just do enjoy it a lot. Next time we are going to stay with friends, which will be very nice. And it was really good to get back there, see the little changes that have occurred, and just embrace the tropics. So having said that, I'm going to take a break, and then when I get back I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies I've got for you, being The Criminal from 1960, starring Stanley Baker. This one is known in the US as Concrete Jungle, so it does have another name, but it's a good gritty little prison film.
The setting for nights beyond forgetting, and through these
apart. Memories live in my heart. When I recall the love I found on, I could kiss the ground on green dolphin street. Dolphin Street supplied the setting, the setting for nights beyond forgetting. And through these moments apart, memories live in my heart. The love I found on, I could kiss the ground on Green Dolphin Street. Green Dolphin Street.
That, of course, was Mr. B, Billy Eckstein, with Green Dolphin, on Green Dolphin Street, from an album called Billy Eckstein in 12 Movies, which is an interesting title for an album because I've only seen him in one movie, and it was really a weird little cameo that he did in a movie called Skirts Ahoy, which starred Esther Williams and Barry Sullivan. The thing is, Esther Williams and Barry Sullivan go out on a date and they're in a nightclub, and suddenly Billy Eckstein pops in to sing one track, and he's the most charismatic thing in the whole fucking movie. He comes in there wearing a slightly too big for him suit, and great lighting effects, and the band's really good, and sings this wonderful song, and then he's out of the movie, and none of anything in the rest of the film is as cool or as groovy as that one little bit where a gentleman of colour comes in and shows them how suave charisma is done. Never saw him in another movie. Don't think he did any other movies. But Billy Eckstein in Skirts Ahoy. I downloaded the whole movie just so I could see Billy Eckstein in it. That's the kind of movie geek and the kind of Billy Eckstein fan that I am. So on with The Criminal. Probably before I do The Criminal, though, I should talk a little bit about Joseph Losey, the man. Really interesting director. He died in the 1980s. Just let me get my IMDb up. In 1984, lived from 1909 to 1984. So he had a fairly good run. He was 75 when he died. He studied philosophy, in fact. He was an unashamed communist. Started working in the theatre, worked with Bertolt Brecht, and he directed some shorts for MGM. He made a really interesting film, which I should talk about at some stage on the podcast. And I say that about a lot of films, but it's true in this case. The Boy with Green Hair, which had Dean Stockwell in it, a really nice little film. He was filming The Prowler, a film noir, in 1951 in Italy, and the House Un-American Activity Security Committee called him in, and he had been named by other people as an active communist. He didn't subject himself to the committee's intimidation tactics. He just pissed off to England, basically. And he used a pseudonym for a few years, Joseph Walton, for his films, which were kind of minor. But he did a thriller called Blind Date in 1959, The Criminal, and Eva in 1962. He also did a really good film, Accident, in 1967 with Dirk Bogarde. And really, any film you see, and he did things like The Damned as well, the Hammer film, which I talked about a while back. But Losey, really interesting director, really thoughtful director, always very politically active. There was always a political edge to whatever he did, including the second movie I'm going to talk about, Modesty Blaze. There's a slight underscoring of politics in that one as well. So really, one of those people whose careers was sidetracked. Oh, no. Thanks for burping. Sounded a bit like I'm on silver and gold. But yeah, his career was sidetracked by the fact that his politics weren't popular with certain very few powerful people in the 1950s. But I think the work he did in England was superb. If you want a checklist of Joseph Losey movies to check out, and of course The Boy with Green Hair from 1948 would be one. He did a remake of M, the Fritz Lang movie, with David Wayne in it in 1951, which is interesting. Check out The Prowler is good. Let's see. Then we get down to The Criminal, of course, The Damned, The Servant, which he did with Dirk Bogarde and James Fox, Accident. He did a really bad movie, which is not uninteresting, called Boom with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, and they were hot shit. He did The Go-Between, did The Assassination of Trotsky. He did Galileo, then a light thing with Glenda Jackson in 1975 called The Romantic English Woman. And he finished up, his last film was had Sarah Miles and Vanessa Redgrave in it called Steaming, which is an adaptation of a play set in a woman's bathhouse in London. And I saw the play performed in Australia back in the early 90s. And there's a lot of female nudity in it. Apart from the fact that it's a quite an interesting play, the fact that basically 60-70% of the females in the cast get their kit off makes it not with our features of interest. I remember seeing it with somebody I was going out with at the time, and I was ready to talk about the characters and the things during the intermission. And we walked across the street to grab a coffee, and the first thing she said was, "Whose tits did you like best?" So, yeah, that's what I remember of the thing that Joseph Losey's last movie was made of. But, yeah, a really interesting director and a serious director, which makes Modesty Blaze in particular a bit of an unusual project, but I'll talk about that later. But let's get on with The Criminal. I'll just play the trailer now, and then I'll tell you why you should watch it.
Kelly hadn't been out long enough to breathe God's fresh air before he was handcuffed back to the concrete jungle, and his jailmates were waiting to welcome a copper's knock. Especially Johnny Banion, whose boys couldn't wait to get their hands on him.
He's down at reception, waiting for his cocoa and slice.
Well, don't keep him hanging about.
Okay, Johnny.
My sadness, oh my joy, came from loving Stephen boy.
We're all in, John. What is it?
It's the members' toll to Tenants' Park on Silver Stakes Day.
John, you know you've got to get a clearance from our mutual friend from Highgate.
I thought you'd clear that.
He just wants a few more details.
What do you want?
John, boy. He's got a right. He's in. It was his 200 I gave you when you came out.
Johnny Banion was out again, ready for another job. This time, he hoped to steal a fortune. And this time, he hoped to get away with it. It was quite a party they were throwing for Johnny. Everyone came, even the cast-offs like Maggie the Blonde.
Get rid of
her. Let me go! Let me go!
Suzanne came. She gate-crashed Johnny's party and stayed to love the thieving boy. Mike Carter, of course, was always around the place. Somebody should have tipped Johnny off about his double-crossing best friend.
I'm afraid things have changed a bit.
How much?
Double. 20%.
You've got some explaining to do, haven't you?
Here they all are, as they are. The tough-as-nails long-termers, the schizos, the narcs, the all-powerful prison barons, the sadistic chief warder.
All topped up, mister?
Yes, sir.
Look, Dr. Banion?
Yes, sir, put him where you said so, in with O'Hara and Flint.
I told you not to put him with them.
Oh, no, sir, I made a note.
Then you've made a mistake, haven't you, mister?
Yes, sir.
Prepare to be shocked as you learn what goes on behind the high walls and the barred windows. As you see for yourselves the whole terrifying world of the underworld and the criminals it protects or kills to order.
Banion and the Cruisers! The Criminal has one of the best ensemble casts I've seen since maybe The Hell Drivers, another Stanley Baker film that I talked about in an earlier podcast. You got Stanley Baker, of course, Sam Wanamaker, who's the father of Zoe Wanamaker, a very well-regarded English actress. He's an American actor. Gregor Aslan, who was in any number of things. If you look up his IMDb listing, he was on all sorts of things. He was in the Hammer film, The Snorkel. He did The Roots of Heaven with John Huston, Our Man in Havana. Let's see, Three Worlds of Gulliver. He was played Carrot in King of Kings. He was in The Devil at 4 o'clock, the movie with Spencer Tracy and Frank Sinatra in it. He was in Cleopatra. He was also the police inspector Gillet in Paris When It Sizzles, another movie I've talked about on the podcast. So you've got him in there. You've got Lawrence Naismith, who played the professor in Valley of Gwangi, in there. John Van Essen, who was in the Hammer Dracula, playing Jonathan Harker. Let's see who else we've got. Kenneth J. Warren, a bald-headed Australian actor playing Clobber. Patrick McGee, the Irish actor, not to be confused with Patrick McNee, playing Barrows, the screw in the prison. Kenneth Cope, another fine English character actor in there. It's Patrick Weimark's first movie as well. Weimark, you might remember from things like, I think it's Blood on Satan's Claw. I'm just going to check that for sure. Just be a moment. He was also in When Eagles Dare. Blood on Satan's Claw. He was the judge in Blood on Satan's Claw. Let's see who else we've got. Brian Phelan's in there. Paul Stasino. Tom Bell. Nigel Green's in there as well, playing one of the henchmen in for the criminal gang. Murray Melvin, a very well-regarded and still alive English actor. He was born in 1932. He played the gay best friend in A Kind of Loving with Rita Tushingham It was A Taste of Honey with Rita Tushingham, Tony Richardson's early film. He was one of the first, he played one of the first sympathetic gay characters in English cinema, which was really a breakthrough at the time. And I remember seeing that film very early on, and it was one of those, for me, seeing Murray Melvin in that film was one of the turning points. I was brought up in a very homophobic environment, but seeing Murray Melvin played sympathetically in A Taste of Honey was the start of that more realistic approach to gay people in general that I came around to later in life than a lot of younger people would now, because gay people were closeted. They could have gone to jail when I was a kid. But seeing a sympathetically portrayed gay character doesn't just help gay kids. I think it helps heterosexual kids come to an acceptance of homosexuality. So very important actor. I've always had a lot of regard for Murray Melville. This is his first film role, in fact, which was kind of cool. The ensemble, as I said, is fantastic. There's Edward Judd. He plays a young warder. You remember Eddie Judd from things like The Day the Earth Caught Fire, for instance. He was in First Men in the Moon. So he was in both of those films. So you just see so many familiar faces in this film, which shows Joseph Losey's skill at picking fine character actors, which is kind of a really interesting approach. The love interest in this movie is an interesting actress as well, Margaret Sard, who did a few Eurospy movies, but she's quite sexy playing Suzanne, the girl who picks up Johnny when he leaves prison. Now, I'll give you a little bit of the story. It's a little bit of a simple plot line in a sense, and it was written by Alan Owen, a jobbing English screenplay writer who worked a lot in television. An ex-con who's taken part in the robbery of a racetrack is caught and sent back to prison. But he won't tell his fellow gang members where he stashed the loot. The gang kidnaps his girlfriend and has him tortured in prison in an effort to find out where the money is. That's a very simplified version of it from IMDb. But you also see Johnny in prison before he's released. And he's a very charismatic character. He's tough, he's smart, he's the leader of men. He runs the wing of the prison that he's in, apart from the screws, of course. But he's the head con in that part of the prison, and a very, very tough character. He's an Irishman. He's a kind of lapsed Catholic, though right at the end, that's in question a little bit. But very, very tough character, and Stanley Baker plays him really well. He's kind of got his mouth pursed. He's tough, and the weird thing is, it's not just a kind of one note toughness about him either. He's an individualist in a criminal world where gangs and organizations are coming to the fore. It's kind of an anachronism in a certain sense, in that he doesn't really play well with others, except in a small gang of his own. He doesn't play well with wider and larger criminal organizations. In fact, he's offsider at the time. The character played by Sam Wanamaker, whose name is Mike Carter, he leaves that kind of business, dealing with the other people, dealing with the people who are going to launder the money for him. He leaves that to Mike Carter, which is one of the flaws he has too. He's very much in his own head, and he's also vulnerable in a lot of weird ways. For instance, in his relationship to his ex-girlfriend Maggie, played by Jill Bennett, in a couple of really tight scenes. That's one of the things that breaks him down. And his new relationship with Suzanne. He's quite fond of the skirt, as indeed when he gets out of prison. You see his flat, and his flat's got some really interesting decorations on it. There's some old 19th century boxing photos, for instance, of prize photos. And yet on the back of his bathroom door, there's a naked woman looking over her shoulder. A photographic kind of stencil of that, and there are nude paintings on the walls and things like that. It's an incredibly masculine and heterosexual kind of space is his apartment. Not a bad looking apartment. It's got some other weird things about it which are really kind of cool. He's got an Eartha Kitt album mounted on the wall and a Julie London album and things like that. So you can tell just by the way his apartment's decorated, it reflects a lot more of the guy's character than you get from just the dialogue and the interactions between the human beings. Taking a look at the space the man lives in is really interesting. But then one of the other flaws too is there's a scene just as the party to welcome him out of jail ends, where you see him framed in a doorway within a doorway, which gives that kind of hint that maybe Johnny Banion is still in a prison of his own making. He goes on and does the robbery at the race course. And the interesting thing is you don't see the robbery in the race course. What you see is him go away with a bookmaker's bag and his wheelman arguing with a guy. Now, the reason the wheelman's arguing with the guy is that the getaway car is a taxi, and this guy's insisting that he be taken to the train station by the taxi. And the wheelman's basically arguing with him until Johnny comes along, solves the problem, and they escape. So you don't see the robbery. The robbery part isn't important. All you need to know is that Johnny's got £40,000, which he hides in a... he digs a hole in a field and hides the money there. That's all you need to know about the robbery. It's not important for the plot of the film. It's not important for the characters to see the little details of the robbery itself. But then again, some people will put it in there because they thought it was expected. But not Losey in this film. The robbery is of very little interest to Joseph Losey. The interesting thing is the character and the way the characters interact. That's the really core of this. Now, Losey has said, and I've got this really good book about the cinema of Joseph Losey, which goes up to his stuff in the mid-60s. It's a book that was published in the 60s called The Cinema of Joseph Losey by James Lay. And it's one of the international film guides of the time, which had some interesting... there were other ones as well. History of Cinema of Orson Welles, Hitchcock's films, The Marx Brothers, French Cinema Since 1946. So I'd be interested in finding a few more of these ones because it's really a good reference to that period of English cinema, and with a specific... each one focusing on a different filmmaker. So what Losey has said about the criminal based on this was, Banyu was modelled on someone I know who was very active in the so-called underworld, and a man who, if his life had taken another direction, could have been a great executive. He could have done anything he wanted to because he has brains, he has humour, he has power, but he has been pushed into this criminal world from which there is really no escape once you get into it. And they have their own code, and their codes of loyalty and behavior are absolute, and if you violate them, the penalties are much greater than in the outside world. But every once in a while, this kind of man lets loose a physical kind of violence that is animal and insane and terrifying and antisocial in a way that no society could tolerate. And I've seen this behavior in the man that I know, and I can like him. I'm interested in him, but I would always be frightened of him because underneath there is an animal that would do anything. And this is what I tried to present in Banyan, and that is this waste. That the prison system hasn't changed, that it doesn't help, that it is a reflection of the society outside, that it has its own organization, its own immediate parallels. It is at once more loyal, more sentimental, more violent, but it's the same thing, and one creates the other. So basically, the prison in this film is a reflection of the outside world. It's got people who are in charge, and this is, again, one of Losey's criticisms of the capitalist system. There are people on the top who control the flow of goods, in this case things like cigarettes and chocolate, and who can bestow favours on people below them, but at an inflated price. So all of this is reflected in the way that Losey portrays the prison, and that absoluteness of the law. At the start of the film, there's a character called Kelly, played by Kenneth Cope, who's basically given some information to the police. And the wardens have told Johnny Banyan, who runs the cell block, that nothing is to happen to Kelly. They can give him the silent treatment, which is all within their guidelines, but there can't be any violence. So what Banyan does is he distances himself from what happens to Kelly by telling people obliquely that it would be horrible if something bad would happen to Kelly, but I don't want to know about that kind of thing. And Clobber, the character played by Kenneth Warren, picks up on this and arranges for Kelly to get a beating, while the person in charge, in this case, Johnny Banyan, can turn a blind eye to it. Which again is a reflection of some aspects of capitalist society, that there are things that the people in charge turn a blind eye to while the underlings do it, particularly in the realm of politics. And there's a good example of that in Australia at the moment. The opposition leader, Tony Abbott, one of his main advisors, has gone up to somebody who's very involved in non-government organisations for Aboriginal health and education. And this assistant to the future potential Prime Minister of Australia has gone up to the guy who's working in Aboriginal welfare and has said to him basically they're going to cut the throat of his programs once they're in government. So it's one of those drunken, stupid, cruel things where the reality of the political process is revealed for a moment. Now, this only got out because a well-respected journalist, Peter Van Onselen, happened to overhear the conversation and tweeted about it on Twitter. But again, leaving aside the modern politics, there are things that go on in the political process and in society in general that the people in power can turn a blind eye to and can plausibly deny. This is before plausible deniability and Watergate and all that, but it's a demonstration of that plausible deniability, which makes it really interesting. And the weird thing is that Johnny Banyan himself, because he has set up his own structure outside the wider accepted structure of the prison and of society and of criminal society, even though he does do things similarly, then becomes a victim of the wider societies he's part of. He becomes a victim in the prison when he goes back into prison after the robbery. And he becomes a victim of the criminal organization when he escapes from prison. So in a sense, it's, you know, big fish eat smaller fish, eat smaller fish, eat smaller fish kind of thing in this film. And Baker is extremely good in this. He's an incredibly charismatic and dynamic actor. And he's an incredibly intelligent actor. There's always a lot of nuance in what Baker does and in his craft. Sam Wanamaker is very good too as Carter, the offsider, who ultimately, and there's no secret in this because it's pretty obvious right from the start, that Baker betrays Johnny in a lot of ways and really does He plays it well. He's nattily dressed and he smokes a cigarette in a cigarette holder, and he really does portray that banality of evil kind of thing in a very fine way in this film. The other standout characters in it are people like Nigel Green's very good in the film too. This is one of his very early roles, and Patrick McGee as Barrows, who the prison officer. There are some little bits of business that Barrows does which show that he knows exactly what's going on all throughout the prison, and there are parts of it that, even though they're against the rules, he approves of personally. So there's a whole bunch of layers in this film, and it's right from the start where John Dankworth's jazz score starts and Dankworth's long-term wife, Cleo Lane, starts singing about thieving boy, as it has in that trailer that I played earlier. That really is a fine piece of work. Not an enormously budgeted movie, but, and it's in black and white, but widescreen. But it really does do a few interesting things. One of the other interesting things that it does is that the prison film was an American genre, pretty much. Don Siegel did it in Riot and Cell Block 13. You've got it in White Heat. You've got it in any number of films. We're No Angels with Bogart. Anything. It's a genre that goes back to the very early 1930s. But it was not one that really was big in England. And what Losey did was he brought it across the Atlantic and showed a lot of the parallels, a lot of the tropes that you get in American prison films, but from an English point of view. And there are elaborations on that too, things like the fact that Banyan is an Irish Catholic and certain other characters are and certain other characters aren't. And because he is Catholic, he does also have a way of talking to Saffron, the character played by Gregor Aslan, who's in charge of the whole prison overall, and who has a lot of contacts on the outside world. And there are a couple of really nice scenes with Aslan showing his kind of power and how his, the way he runs his cell block is very different from the way Johnny Banyan runs his cell block. And the fact that Saffron's organization is a lot more nuanced and a lot more subtle and a lot more powerful because of that. And there's almost a kind of foreshadowing of the way Marlon Brando is treated in The Godfather, in the way that Losey portrays Saffron, the Aslan character, in this film. Really, you know, he's like the Don who has a conciliary, and the code of honour that his people have is a lot more formalised than the informal roughneck one that Johnny Banyan expects of the people that he controls. So, in general, this is a fine little film. There are a lot of things that you've seen in other films, in it, particularly other prison films. But this is one of the reasons you see it in those other films is that you've seen this one started it. And that's always our problem with going back and looking at older films. You see a lot of tropes that are familiar to you, but you're seeing them at their source rather than at the 15th or 20th iteration of them that has come about. But this one's not the best known of Losey's films. I mean, things like The Servant and Accident and a number of other ones are a lot more well known than this. But this is a good, solid little drama. And the fact that it plays out in the English wintertime with the stark, leafless trees and snow on the ground and the hard, unforgiving soil when he buries the loot and things like that, it does play really well. And that it gives it an extra bleakness by setting it at that time of the year. So in general, I picked this up very, very cheaply on DVD, and I'm really glad that I did. It's one of those things where if you got to see a stack of DVDs for $5, chances are there's going to be at least one or two movies in a large stack that surprise you when you do watch them. And that was the case with this one. I picked it up really cheaply. And because basically off the back of the fact that it's got Stanley Baker and it was directed by Joseph Losey. And in watching it, it really is one of my top five or six prison films because it does show things from a different light and it shows an ensemble of actors that is the best of the available English actors at the time. And I really do like that. Not the star actors. There's no Richard Burton's in this one. And, you know, you're not going to get Michael Caine and Peter O'Toole live in that, they would be famous after this. But good, solid character actors. This movie is replete with them. And it's well worth checking out. As I said before, it does have a different title in the US, Concrete Jungle, but the English title is The Criminal. And really worth checking out. Now, I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about something a little lighter. The 1966 spy spoof, Modesty Blaze, with Monica Vitti and Terrence Stamp. Modesty. Okay, let's talk about Modesty Blaze. I am an enormous fan of the novels Peter O'Donnell wrote based on this character and also the comic strips as well. So leaving that aside, this movie strays enormously from the comic strips and the books. But in a sense, we have to thank the movie for some of that. The character of Modesty Blaze and her sidekick Willie Garvin were created by Peter O'Donnell for a newspaper strip in the early 1960s. They wanted a female James Bond character for the newspaper strip, and O'Donnell came up with the idea. He'd already written a few different newspaper strips. He'd been in World War II. He was a fine action writer, so he gave them the idea, and they ran with it, and it became incredibly successful at the time and on into the 21st century. Now, having said that, the movie does stray a lot from the characters, so I do have to put down my credentials as being a Modesty Blaze fan. The movie's totally different. But the nice thing about the movie is it led to the books. Peter O'Donnell was approached in 1964 to adapt the comic strips to a movie. He wrote a screenplay for it, which then, of course, due to the processes these things go through, was rewritten first by a guy called Evan Jones, a Jamaican guy. Harold Pinter had a little bit of input into it, and a couple of other people. The usual thing that happens with screenplays before they actually get filmed. So, at the time, O'Donnell was pissed off. He invested a lot in the character. He had a great fondness for it. He didn't want it messed around too much. So he then asked whether he could do a novelization of the script he had written originally for the movie. And the studio said yes. So O'Donnell wrote the script. It was published by Sovereign Press and then went on to write 12 other books of Modesty Blaze. So the movie, in a sense, was the impetus that Peter O'Donnell needed to go from writing newspaper strips that were illustrated at the time by a guy called Jim Holdaway, who gave it that classic Modesty Blaze look, into the novels, which went on to sell millions, literally millions. You can find them in secondhand bookshops if you're careful. You can find them on eBay. Sovereign Press releases them every few years, all the way up to the last collection, Cobra Trap, which came out, I think, around the turn of the millennium. Peter O'Donnell, unfortunately, at the age of 90, died in 2010, so there aren't going to be any more. Now, there have been other adaptations of the characters too. The BBC has done a few audio adaptations. There, of course, was a 1983 attempt to do a TV pilot, Americanizing her and having Modesty Blaze played by Anne Turkell, who people might remember was married to Richard Harris at one stage and starred with him in 99 of 4400 % Dead. Didn't really work. And then in 2004, Miramax, who had the rights to make Modesty Blaze movies, needed to make a movie to retain the rights to it. So they got a mate of Quentin Tarantino's called Scott Spiegel to do a quickie movie called My Name is Modesty, and it tells the story of some of Modesty Blaze's early adventures before she met Willie Garvin and before she retired from a life of crime. Now, just got to give a bit of background to the movie. As I said, it does drift from the character, which some people can simplify as being a kind of female James Bond, but that's not really the case. I'll see what IMDb has to say about the synopsis of the movie. Let's have a look here. Here we go. There's two of them, so I'll read them both out. Modesty Blaze, a secret agent whose hair colour, hairstyle and mod clothing change at a snap of her fingers, is being used by the British government as a decoy in an effort to thwart a diamond heist. She's being set up by the feds, but is wise to the plot and calls in psychic Willie Garvin and a few other friends to outsmart them. Meanwhile, in his island hideaway, Gabriel, the diamond thief, has his own plans for Blaze and Garvin. The other one reads, Great Britain is giving £50 million worth of diamonds to a Middle East sheikh in return for oil concessions. There are rumours of a plot by arch-criminal Gabriel to steal the diamonds, so the Secret Service chief seeks the help of sexy spy Modesty Blaze, who brings along a psychic Willie Garvin. That's basically it. Now, having said that, and having kind of dismissed the movie a little bit, there are some complexities to it that I've really got to kind of go into. Monica Vitti looks very good as Modesty Blaze, but this was her first English language film and it wasn't her strength. And I'm not sure, even though she did look great, I'm not sure she was tough enough to play the character as I see it anyway. But she's a charming actress. For 10 years, she was the companion of Michelangelo Antonioni and starred in things like La Ventura and L'Eclisse and a few other arty films around the early part of the 1960s, so she's very well known and well regarded as an actress. Terence Stamp plays her sidekick Willie Garvin, and this is Terence Stamp at his best looking. These days he's got a bit of a rough mug and he's a little bit older, but Terence Stamp in his day was right up there with John Philip Law when it comes to good looking guys. A good actor, and he's gone on to do some marvellous things in his career, and he's kind of not quite walking through this role, but he's got a certain casualness about it that is kind of interesting. Now, the movie, basically, at the surface of it, is a bit of a dog's breakfast. It's campy at times. There are some serious attempts to build up the tension, which are then dissipated unnecessarily. And the villain, Gabriel, played very, very, very campily by Dirk Bogarde, steals the movie. He's fantastic in this, and seeing Dirk Bogarde play a lot lighter is a really interesting choice. He worked with Joseph Losey 6 times in 6 different films, and all of them were great. He started out in the 50s as a bit of a matinee idol kind of actor, doing a series of doctor movies, Doctor at Sea, Doctor in Charge, things like that. But then in the early 60s, he did Victim, where he played a closeted gay barrister who was threatened with blackmail and who's got defending gay people in court and things up. But I'm not explaining that well, but it's a really fine film. And it was one of the influential films that helped decriminalise homosexuality in England at the time by putting the argument that by criminalising it, it leaves people open to be blackmailed. And there's no two ways about it. In Victim, this is portrayed very explicitly. Bogart became known as a serious actor. Of course, he was himself gay, which did make his portrayal in Victim a lot more intense. And then, of course, he went on all the way through his career to do things like The Night Porter, for instance. He did a really interesting couple of Euro spy movies, one called Sebastian, which he did with Susanna York, and another one called Hot Enough for June. It's also known as Agent 8 and 3 Quarters for some reason. It's a Ralph Thomas kind of comedy thing with Sylvia Shoshina and Robert Morley in it. And that one's a bit of fun too. So the interesting thing here is that Bogart could do serious, but he could also do comedy as well. And became a well-respected writer as well as an actor. He wrote several volumes of his own memoirs, which are really interesting reads. And I recommend that people go out and find them and give them a go. I've picked up a few copies, remade it, and they do make a really good read. So you've got all of this set up. And Losey himself, this was a very atypical project for him, doing a kind of spy spoof with a big budget for a major studio really wasn't his bag, but he does give it a terrific sensibility. On the surface, it's all pop art and grooviness and very kind of mid-1960s swinging stuff. I don't think it holds together cohesively. Maybe there were too many writers or things like that, but what Losey then decided to do, maybe because he wasn't particularly interested in doing a decent Eurospy movie, was he put in lots of sly humour into the film. There are any number of sly digs in there. The Secret Service Chief, Gerald Tarrant, played by Harry Andrews, one of our favourites here at Paleo Cinema, is quite wry at times. The fact that he corrects his minister, who keeps getting the facts wrong when he's talking about the briefing he's giving to Modesty Blaise. And he's just kind of putting in sly digs at the establishment while very much appearing to be part of it with a bowler hat and the suit and the umbrella, that kind of thing. And there are also some digs at upper-class pretension as well in the film. Abu Tahir, the oil sheikh who is getting them diamonds from the British government, played by Clive Revel, who also plays McWhirter, Gabriel's sidekick, gets in a number of digs. He's given a gift of a cannon, so he decides to use it when he's staying at the Ritz, but they're really concerned that the cannon's aimed at Buckingham Palace, but it's okay to let it off through another window, which is aimed at Parliament House. So there are lots of little wry digs, and the movie does bear close watching in that sense, to just kind of pick out the little bits and pieces of anti-establishment stuff, and not necessarily anti-establishment for the sake of that, but Losey being a communist really does dig in a few spurs at times during the making of this movie. And also he also takes the piss out of the fact that he's making a spy parody, and in a sense there's another level of the film where he's taking the piss out of spy parodies. For instance, there's a bit where Modesty Blaise is shooting an arrow at a guy to kill him, and you can see the arrow go past him before an arrow comes in from another angle. Now this isn't something Losey's done just out of clumsiness and silliness. He's done it deliberately to break down the fourth wall. There are a couple of times when the fourth wall's broken down where Gabriel says that he's the villain of the piece, and Modesty Blaise says, well, I'm the heroine, shouldn't I win? There are those little bits of knowing that they're in a movie kind of stuff. And there are, the locations are really nice. There's some great locations in Amsterdam, for instance. There are some bits around London. There are some that appear to be on a Greek island, though I can't find where the location is. It doesn't have it in IMDb. But overall, I would love a copy of the poster, because I think the poster art for this film is fantastic, and I'll try to do a grab of it to put up on the Paleo Cinema website. It's pure pop art silliness on one level. It's unsuccessful at one level as well, because the tone changes during the film don't really work. There are times when they could ramp up the tension and do some really good stuff with it, particularly when one of their informants, Nicole, is being chased by some thugs through a night market in Amsterdam. There are some opportunities there that were missed to do a good ramping up tense piece of action. But they were kind of lost, because they suddenly go into a Max Sennett comedy bit with a speeded up camera and rinky-dink music, which kind of doesn't work. Now, the music itself, is by Johnny Dankworth, who did the music for The Criminal, is pretty iconic stuff. You heard the earlier cover version of the theme, Modesty Blaze, which kind of has become a bit of a loungy, space-age pop iconic piece of music in some ways. I think the Modesty Blaze movie is a kind of missed opportunity, but I'm saying that from 40 odd years on, it's a little bit difficult to kind of second guess a movie that old and say it should have been done this way, because we've seen spy movies done right, thinking of Skyfall being the most recent example. So we've got a lot more history, and we know a lot more about the genre than people did in 1966, when it was just peaking and Bond mania was really, really big and everybody was jumping on the bandwagon and taking every opportunity to either make spy movies or make spy spoofs, which were a lot easier to do than to make a decent spy movie. But having said that, I think that Losi took the project on. He wanted to work with Bogart again. He wanted to have a financial success as well, but he wasn't really interested in taking the project to any level of seriousness, and so he decided to camp it up a little bit to have it be a bit of fun. This is just before the spoof Casino Royale was made. In fact, the cinematographer went on to make Casino Royale. Cinematographer of Modesty Blaze went on to make Casino Royale later, so it's kind of an artifact of its time. It's pop art. It'll look good if you just turn the sound off and have it up on the wall as a bit of eye candy to watch while you're doing other things. But I'm not sure it's as successful as Losi wanted it to be. But there are those little slide digs that kind of are a saving grace of the film. Now, I would love to see a serious Modesty Blaze film done. Tarantino's been circling around doing one for nearly 20 years. In fact, if you have a look in Pulp Fiction, the book that John Travolta's character is holding when he walks out of the toilet and gets shot by Bruce Willis isn't the first Modesty Blaze novel, so there's a little bit of iconography there. It's one of those ones that could be reinvented and could really work well, but you'd have to have the dedication to do it. No, I would love to see Tarantino do a Modesty Blaze film. I think he's got respect for the property, and he could do it really well. In fact, I think that his Kill Bill movies do owe a certain amount to Modesty Blaze as far as female action heroes are concerned. So there's not too much else to say about it. You can probably check it out. It is available on DVD. It is part of the Eurospy genre that I still like, and I'm still finding new things to watch in. But I don't think it's one of those movies where I've got such goodwill for it. You really want it to be better than it is. You keep trying to push, mentally push while you're watching it to see whether things change. It's a bit like rewatching a movie and expecting a different ending, in a sense. I want this movie to be a lot better than it is. Even if it was a better spoof or a better serious attempt to adapt the property to a movie, I'd really like it either way. It's a bit of fun, and it does show Losi doing something different. I think it's pretty much the only film he's got with any kind of real comedy in it. I could be wrong, and I'm willing to be corrected on that, but I can't think of any other ones that weren't a lot more serious than this film. But it is kind of iconic in that sense that visually it's very pop art. There's the island where Gabriel has his headquarters. There are some beautiful pop art rooms in that, in those scenes of the film. And it's just got this kind of 1960s sensibility that is quite attractive in the design and the attitudes, and the clothing is brilliant. If you're into frocks and films, this movie is brilliant for that as well. And that's about really it to say for the 1966 Modesty Blaze. You can find the pilot for the TV series Modesty Blaze from 1983. If you go to dailymotion.com and type in Modesty Blaze pilot, you'll find it. That's where I picked up my copy of it, though I did have a VHS copy of it a lot of years that I picked up from Video Search in Miami back in the day. But you can get that. And My Name is Modesty is, in this, at least in Australia, available on DVD. And I've got a copy of that as well. And I do kind of like that, even though I think the actress who plays Modesty Blaze in this just the tiniest bit too skinny for the role. I think she does an okay job as far as acting's concerned. But that's about it for that. I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, it's going to be the feedback.
Once in a lifetime, a man knows a moment, one wonderful moment, when fate takes his hand. And this is my moment, my once in a lifetime, when I can explore a new and exciting land. For once in my lifetime, you know I feel like a giant. I saw like an eagle, as though I had wings. For this is my moment, my destiny calls me. It may be just once in my lifetime, I'm gonna do great things. Just once in a lifetime, a man knows a moment, one wonderful moment, when fate grabs his hand. This is my moment, my once in a lifetime, when I can explore a new and exciting land. Oh, once in my lifetime, you know I feel like a giant. I'm gonna soar like an eagle, as though I had wings. Oh, this is my moment, my destiny calls me.
The time is always right for a bit of Bobby Darin, Las Vegas style. That's Once in a Lifetime by Bobby Darin. On to the feedback, and we did have some, which is quite gratifying. Dave Brandt sent a comment through to the blog website saying, the theme of this podcast reminded me of a bittersweet favourite of mine. It's Mr. Altman's Farewell, A Prairie Home Companion. It's different from the two movies you reviewed in at least a couple of dimensions. He got them. I'm thinking of two of the roles that went to actors instead of singers, the semi-fictionist Johnson sisters. He could have cast professional singers as the singers. That would have made sense if he had only tried to make a concert film. Instead, he cast actors as singers. From Meryl Streep's entrance on, it was obvious why he was not making a concert film. He was making a Robert Altman movie. He used the radio show as a metaphor of life and death. For that, he needed the best actors he could find. And then Dave sent through a link to the Roger Ebert's review of A Prairie Home Companion, which I haven't seen. I've seen a lot of Altman films, but I haven't seen A Prairie Home Companion. Now I'm going to have to watch it. So thanks for that, Dave. And thanks for the parallel, too. Yeah, I do like actors singing who aren't really singers. I've got tons and tons of tracks of them, anything from Joe Pesci onwards. There's really, it's an endless font of wonderfulness, which just keeps on giving if you look into it. Even people like Sophia Loren, she couldn't hold a tune in an iPad, really. But it's a lot of fun to just explore that. And it's also fun to see very successful people fail at something else. Not for the schadenfreude of doing that, but to show that they can make mistakes and to show that somebody who's brilliant in one realm is kind of ordinary in another, but is given the opportunity to give it a go anyway. And I kind of, something in me likes that. And I really find it interesting. Yeah, I found some sound effects that I had saved but hadn't used yet for the podcast. So I'm going to throw them in now because I can. Here we go. Here's another one. This one's kind of a movie projector, so I should have put it at the start of the podcast, but what the hell. I did get some feedback as well from Timothy Lieber, who says, Terry, hearing you read your introduction to your book brought back a lot of memories for me. Like you, I came of age in the late 60s/70s with a long-standing love of the kind of movies, horror, SF, exploitation, action, that my parents strongly disapproved of. The biggest difference between our upbringing was that my dad was career army and my parents were Christian conservatives. So I didn't see anybody in my family so much as drink a glass of wine or beer until I was nearly an adult. Just a brief correction based on your introduction. J. Edgar Hoover had almost nothing to do with bootleggers during Prohibition, even after the FBI, then the Division of Investigations, was folded into the Bureau of Prohibitions in 1933. While the FBI officially claims that the job was to bring down gangsters, in fact they steered well clear of bootleggers. Hoover believed that all the money would corrupt his men. Thanks for that, Timothy, and I stand corrected. I'm always happy to be corrected on that, and I will make the correction on it if it's in the text. But yeah, thank you. It was an interesting time to grow up, and one of the things that really does fascinate me is that difficulty in accessing films at the time. The way that we were waiting so much for a technology that personalize the movie experience down to the individual level, and we've got it now, and people who were born with that, even if it's just VHS, have a different relationship to film than those of us who didn't grow up with those technologies, rudimentary though some of them were, available to us. But that disconnect is a fascinating thing for me, and I think it was incredibly formative for me as a person, let alone as a movie watcher, to have had those experiences. So let's move on from there. I did get an email from Richard Palmer over at The Rotcast, which I recommend. Definitely run that through Google and you'll find what I mean. And I've just lost the page again. Here we go. Richard says, Terry, been listening, of course. I've also a new computer and have been nose to the grindstone at work. Just watched The Proposition. I put it up on my Netflix queue and forgot where the recommendation came from, but pretty much had to come from your show. I enjoyed it. It was very different. A poetic Western with nicely timed surprises. The coming and going of John Hurt were two of my favourite unexpected moments. Never saw so many flies. They were like another character. I briefly contemplated that the point of view was from the flies because there was buzzing added to the soundtrack, but didn't seem likely after a while. Thanks for mentioning my show again. I should have Podcast 26 up on iTunes soon, a couple of Clockwork Orange. We'll hope to make Rockcast promo to share after that. I've been experimenting and listening to podcasts on Fast Forward, but you should be gratified to know that I listen to Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive at normal speed. They are to be savoured. Talk to you soon. P.S. Once you've tipped me to a movie I've never heard of, I've added the specials to my list. That was actually related to Martian Driving. But thanks for that, Richard. And unfortunately, it wasn't me who recommended The Proposition. It's on my list as well, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. Definitely will, because I like Nick Cave as a writer more than I like him as a singer or an entertainer. And I do want to get that, and I always like to get myself a little bit of Ray Winston when I can. But yeah, I mean, that's what we're doing here. We're sharing the love and we're sharing recommendations. It's like we're a whole bunch of old maids sharing recipes that we picked up from somewhere. In this case, the recipes, of course, being movies. But yeah, I mean, keep up the good work with The Rockcast. And if you're doing Clockwork Orange, I haven't seen that since I saw it in the cinema way back when Jesus was playing Cowboys. But I really should get a copy of it on Blu-ray and give it a go. I'm pretty sure it is out on Blu-ray in Australia, though I'll go and maybe correct it on that. I did pick up a couple of interesting Blu-rays recently as well, I should mention. I've got a nice Russian science fiction one that you might want to add to your list, people. Black Lightning, which is about a flying car and is very cool. It's very much got the same feel as Night Watch and Day Watch, if you want into that kind of a vibe. I picked up Miramax, the Neil Gaiman-based movie. I'm just looking at the shelf now to see what I got. There was this thing where there were three Blu-rays for $20 when I was up in Darwin, so I filled the suitcase up. I got Oliver Stone's The Doors, which I'm going to have to watch on Blu-ray as well, and a few other bits and pieces. Nothing kind of out of the mainstream, really, but it was good to pick up some things that I had on some dodgy DVDs and to enhance the experience by getting them as Blu-rays. I'm buying more and more of them now. And now that I've hacked my Blu-ray player, when I pay off this holiday we just had, I may start looking at buying a lot more Blu-rays from the United States, where they do seem to be incredibly cheap compared to the price we pay for them here. So thanks for that one, Richard. Just be a moment, I'll see what other feedback we have here. Here we go. I got one from Ken Krimstein, which is kind of groovy. It says, Illinois, America, near Chicago, brr cold. So this was on the 14th of March, I got this. I have a few minutes, so I thought I'd write and tell you how much I've enjoyed dipping into the podcast, discovering Dr. Zwiebzom. All your missives. I cracked up on your joint podcast about chick flicks today. Funny stuff. I appreciate the way you appreciate film, and I echo the audio vote from a listener in Cleveland. This is a community and a passion. Remembering some of the films I've seen, but not for a while, discovering new ones and connecting to a visual of Oz. I worked for a spell in Hong Kong with a bloke from Melbourne via Tasmania. Anyhow, movies. Well, I'm totally grokking your vibe and passion. I love how you said you enjoy getting outside of your familiar lair and discovering. That's a great way for us cine buffs to connect. I'm fascinated with Lang. I'm trying to pin you down while the City Sleeps review. If you really want some obscure and cool Lang, His House by the River is divine and creepy. I believe Scarlet Street and Woman in the Window are epochal, and I think everywhere you turn with Lang, I love your praise on the Mabuses, there is gold. I personally believe Hangman Also Died could be the greatest war movie ever because it's about people. Zero sentimentality, total sentiment. Lang's a tough man, but a tough, maniacal humanist like Kubrick. By the way, just went to a screening and discussion by the amazing Chicago film critic Jonathan Rosenbaum on Full Metal Jacket. Hadn't seen it since it came out, and it was a scratchy 35mm print. Holy shit, he called it Kubrick's most avant-garde movie, and he's not far wrong. It kind of sort of blows away Apocalypse Now, except for some of the vibe from the director's cut. By the way, I loved your discussion on Luton films. Other passions of mine, you may take your places, Herzog, Werner, his documentaries, even Fata Morgana, of course, Aguirre, but the early films, all of them. Love his concept of ecstatic truth, that is essential thinking. You've also dipped into Ophuls, I see, though I haven't had a chance to catch up with your discussion of, I believe, La Ronde yet. For my money, Letter from an Unknown Woman is about as good as Hollywood ever got. When you think about those Euro directors and writers in Hollywood, it's truly fascinating. Renoir's later films, and of course his earlier films, I guess it would be all of his films. Well, this humanism to rival the Archers. By the way, thanks for the amazing Exegesis. There's a misspelled 25-cent word for you of Colonel Blimp. It was marvellous. But Renoir's The River from Rumour Godden. Good Godden. Lest I seem too highbrow, I think I never laughed so hard as I did at the end of something called Call Me Bwana. And I do love what you did with Mad, 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 Mad World and Tati. But his widescreen film, his widescreen film, the name escapes me at the moment, the one that broke him. Well, check out the criterion, the notes are by my man Rosenbaum. Funny, well, producers, Aeroplane, Animal House, I will dig your Bedazzled, Ealing's of course. Always had a soft spot for the one about the captain and his wife on either side of the Straits of Gibraltar, Captain's Paradise and Passport to Pimlico. Well, anyway, long winded way of saying hello and to keep it going. Maybe someday I'll try to do the audio thing. This is making my fingers tired. Best, Ken. P.S. Loved your thing on Pepe Le Moko. Looks like Ken's been going through the archive there. Yeah, thanks a lot, Ken. You actually tipped me a few things. I'm going to have to look into more Ophuls, for instance, and dip into the more obscure Lang when I get a chance. And getting the chance is the hard part, of course. One of the things about the internet is it's ubiquitous distraction, and things will grab my attention and hold them for way too long when I should be looking at more worthy things. But thanks, Kevin. I'm glad you like the stuff. Keep it going. Any feedback you want to give me by whichever means, we'll muddle through with them. Always happy to do that. And yeah, I'm glad you got into it. I'm going to have to get Zom back on again. I haven't talked to him in a little while, but the man is a lovely human being, and I want to get a little bit more stuff from him as well. The other thing I want to do, which I haven't had a chance to do yet, is at some stage I want to get Ivor Cole, my mate from Darwin, who does the radio gig, onto the podcast at some stage. Now, I'm not sure how that matches up with his obligations with the ABC, but at some stage I'm going to rope him in, get some Skype happening, and Ivor and I are going to talk movies. We talked a lot of stuff while I was up in Darwin as well, so we caught up then, and our discussion on movie music was a lot of fun. It was done at about 9 o'clock at night, stinking hot tropical night, both of us sitting in a studio in a pool of light. It's kind of like that scene where Barry Sullivan and Kirk Douglas figure out how to do the horror movie in The Bad and the Beautiful. We're in a pool of light with a couple of microphones there. I was just dipped out before that for a cigar outside, and we're just grooving on the movies, talking out in between the tracks when, yeah, when the music's playing. We're having a little bit of a chat ourselves while the music's playing, then linking the tracks together and me talking about the movies that the music came from. That was a lot of fun. It was a weird and rare experience where we were the only two people in ABC Darwin at that time of night. And Offer does it that way every night. He's the only person in the building, apart from the cleaner who pops in and out sometimes. But I do want to get Ivor on. Our friendship got better while I was up there, and we got a lot more time to hang out and just shoot the shit. Interesting guy, fascinating guy. So I do want to get him on at some stage to have a chat from my end of things. But anyway, that's about it for this podcast. I'm going to wrap it up now. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast when I'm looking at Planeta Burr, a Russian science fiction movie from 1960, and probably Nochnoi Dozor, Night Watch, the not too long ago Russian fantasy film. So anyway, look after yourselves, keep watching good films. Feedback to the usual places, cultguru@gmail.com, or you can drop me an mp3 so my throat doesn't wear out. And thanks for your attention, and I'll be back with another Paleo Cinema as well in 4 weeks. Have no idea what I'm going to do, but I want it to be a little more upmarket, so I'm going to have to lift my game a little bit, I think. So take care, I'll catch you later.